All right, so what's up with all this rainy weather lately? I'm sure it may be the fault of our weather guys, maybe not. John Martin, wow. Steve Ackerman. John Martin, a professor of and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
Steve Martin, or Steve Ackerman.
You have one of those mornings, aren't you?
I think that one other time, I think, to you.
Under a cloud of accusation and now comedy.
Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and is a professor in that Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Get an update on what's been going on with climate and weather. What was the weather like in your area this weekend? You may have some questions about the weather or about climate. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, I'm talking about rain. And we did get, in some parts of Wisconsin, a lot of rain, not to the extent of maybe are for sure of Louisiana.
Not that flooding situation, but right. We're like 6 inches above normal for the summer.
Yeah, there's been a wet summer, and Steve brought my attention for our weekly column, brought our attention to the fact that all 3 months have been above normal, and August is the one that's most above normal. And the 19th?
Yeah,
2.74 inches of rain in one day, which is pretty high for Southern Wisconsin. That was in Madison, so that's unusual.
Because Baton Rouge got like 3 feet.
How much did they really get?
There were places that had nearly 30 inches of rain in a day.
Yeah.
In that part of Louisiana.
That much?
Yeah, that much.
Yep.
How does it happen?
I don't know the answer. I'm not going to give you the answer, but an exceptional amount of water vapor in the air, just moisture-laden air, and then driven by a circulation that wouldn't quit for 24 hours.
Wouldn't go away, it just stayed around.
So it was a conspiracy of ugly circumstances.
I mean, I knew it rained a lot, but I had 30 inches.
It's astounding.
Yeah, that's why
just flooded. Just astounding.
So we don't really know why Wisconsin and other parts of the country, why we're getting so much rain?
Well, the further south you go, the closer you are to the tropics, and it's certainly true in Baton Rouge and places like that. I mean, they really are a tropical station, effectively, in the summertime. And the occasional exceptional rainfall is going to happen. This one was really outrageous. Up here, sometimes we get a wet summer and sometimes we don't. Was it August 2008, I think, or maybe 2006? We had an event in the middle. I think it was the 18th of August. Ben Moore at SUNY Albany did a really nice work study on this 6 or 8 inch rainfall, and there was a big dam, an earthen dam that gave way southwest part. Remember that?
Lake Delvin.
So we've had some exceptional events ourselves, but not like the one down in Louisiana.
That is just so unusual. It's just hard for me to imagine. That now, is that one of those 1 in 1,000 year rains?
I think
they were looking at that as statistically. It was like 1 in 1,000.
But it seems like we're getting more of these 1 in 1,000.
That's right.
Sure. Yeah, 1 in 100 anyway. Which is
You base that return time on your current climatology. So if your climatology is changing under your feet, then you're definitely going to have more of those. That's right.
You know, this summer, to me, I'm thinking about it, this summer seemed more hotter than usual.
It was. The summer was warmer than normal and wetter than normal in terms of precipitation. Part of it's going to feel heavy. With more water vapor in the air, it's going to feel hotter as well.
I was just going to say, we had probably a more humid summer than the second two-thirds of it anyway than we've had in many recent summers, too. So it was consistently oppressive feeling.
Yeah. Is this the new norm, or is...
It's heading that way. I think when they look at, out to the year 2050, which isn't that far away, they're looking at our weather being like, comparison to other states, if you just kind of think about what the temperature and the moisture is. Missouri?
Yeah, right. Southern Missouri.
Southern Missouri. So that's,
and another conspicuous aspect of this summer thus far anyway has been the relatively small number of days with a temperature above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I think it's been three, right?
Yeah.
And yet many people would admit readily, it's felt like kind of a hot, oppressive summer. So we've been in the mid to high 80s a few times with high dew points in the low 70s, sometimes mid 70s. And that combination is just as bad as 95 degrees.
Well, what does it feel like when it's when it's a temperature like that and a humidity like that?
We had a few days this summer with heat indices above 105,
degrees,
I think.
Yeah.
So half a dozen maybe even more than that.
Oh, man. Well, what's the outlook for, let's get out of the state for a minute. What's the outlook for hurricanes this year?
So they were looking at normal hurricanes. I think they've just updated that. I think initially they were looking between, I think the average number of named hurricanes is like 10 a year.
Yeah, something.
And they
like
were
that.
Looking initially at, I think it was like, you know, just a little bit above that or around that. And now they've yanked it up a little bit because we've had 8 hurricanes, right?
Yeah.
Gaston.
Yeah. Gaston. Yeah.
Walt Disney shows. And there are 2 more brewing, 2 more tropical depressions, I guess, that may go up over Florida. One of them may hit Florida and dump a lot of rain there.
But don't some of those actually have some effect on us here, don't they? Not the ones in Florida.
Well, the one that we, the heavy rain event we were just talking about here from August, I'm going to just say the year, I might be wrong, 2008. That particular rain event was tied to a tropical system that was in the western Gulf of Mexico and affected the coast of Texas. But it was way out ahead of the tropical system. But the moisture that's involved in that storm made its way as far north as Wisconsin and then got involved in a frontal circulation and got dropped on us as a heavy precipitation event. So in that way, we can feel some of the long field effects of tropical storms, but we don't ever get visited by one as a tropical storm.
What's it? Somebody was asking me, what's new on the horizon in terms of research and in terms of forecasting? And I said, I'll bring that up with the weather guys.
Maybe research on forecasting. I'll put them together as my answer on this. I think one of the things we've been working to try and figure out better is looking past about 5 to 7 days and somehow increasing the extended range forecast. We do run up against the theoretical limit that we understand from work by Ed Lorenz in the 60s, early 60s, that maybe we can't go past 14 days in any sort of deterministic way. In other words, I can't tell you with any specificity how 2 weeks from today the weather will be. There's just a horizon on the predictability somewhere around that range. But that leaves us a little bit of room to go from where we are now, which I think a 5-day forecast is fairly accurate now, out to maybe 10 to 12 days, and that's one of the places that people are trying to figure out how they might be able to do that better. And it'll include satellite data simulation. It'll include all kinds of other data sources that we try to put into our numerical forecast models, as well as understanding how the large scale and the small scale evolve on such long time scales. And so you want to combine your new knowledge and your new computer models with some sense of judgment that you'd develop over a period of trying to do that over some time.
And just to follow up on that, how are we on satellites? Are we behind?
We're
not ahead, I'm pretty sure. But.
We are not ahead anymore. We are. It's interesting because NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who runs the operational weather satellites, and NASA, who does a lot of the research weather satellites, are actually entering their decadal and beyond questions about what are we going to fly. So NASA looking at 2017 and beyond, and NOAA looking at 2030 and beyond. And, you know, so that's the good news, I think. The thing that shows that we're behind is I just saw this animation the other day from a satellite that China is running. It's an array that was looking at overshooting tops on 2 thunderstorms. So I don't know what the scale was. I don't remember what the horizontal scale was. But 2 thunderstorms, so it's got to be pretty big.
Yeah.
Spatial resolution on the order of 100 meters.
Ooh, boy.
7-second data.
Wow.
So it's like being on a plane, you know, just on a helicopter above these storms, watching them bubble over.
Wow.
And we don't have anything like that or anything like that on the books. Yeah. So we continue, I would argue, to fall behind in the other nations in terms of the weather satellites that we have.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Well, we can come back to that, but let's go to Dale in Whitewater, who has a totally different question. Dale, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We were up by New Auburn a couple weeks ago. It was probably a Wednesday or Thursday night, and for about 2.5 to 3 hours, all we could hear was rolling thunder. It never ceased. It kept rolling and rolling. Then it quit for about half an hour or so, and then it started up for about another half an hour. And when it moved north that we could hear it better by us, we had some light rain, and it would, like, move south. And it very little lightning we saw, but just we're curious why it rumbled that long.
Ah, that's interesting.
That's a good,
lucky too. First, I'd say you're lucky that that's a great show. Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say that, you know, so you get your lightning bolt and that generates a sound wave that we know as thunder. And the closer you are to that lightning bolt, the crisper that sound's going to be and the louder that sound's going to be.
Yeah.
But as sound waves then progress through the atmosphere, then they bend and get modified as they flow around objects, and you can turn that crisp sound into a rolling type sound, as we often describe it. And so I'll bet that's what it was. I bet there was a really active storm with a lot of lightning. And you were just hearing those sound waves as they propagated.
And how far away would that be before, I mean, the further away, I guess, the the more rolling.
How far it wouldn't be uncommon for the lightning bolts to be 50 miles away. Some of them are 50 miles long, we're finding out, with new instrumentation. Yeah, it's amazing. But then again, the sound waves, how far they're going to propagate, is really going to be a function of what the atmosphere structure is and what kind of objects they're running into.
Yeah. And also the thing that when I've heard rolling thunder, and I always enjoy when I do, is that it becomes not just that it's louder when you're close to the storm, but the association between a particular lightning flash and the thunder is much more distinct. And when you're far away and you don't even see any of the lightning, as you're testifying to, all you're hearing is the aftermath, the sound aftermath, and it gets all mixed together. And so that's, I think, why it sounds like it's rolling continuously for 3 hours, because it's an amalgamation of all the sound waves from, you know, hundreds of different lightning strikes, all of which are distinctly sending off a sound wave. But you're only hearing the whole, you know, the whole mass of
the
them.
The symphony of them.
Yeah, right. The symphony is what it is. It's fantastic. Oh, man, that's a lucky thing.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Carl in Verona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask a guest, since the climate is a chaotic system, deterministic chaos, and now we have all these positive feedbacks that are being they're coming into play, I wondered if the climate could flip to a new attractor in a very short period of time, like a couple years or a few months or something, that's significantly warmer than it is now, instead of taking a century or so to warm by 6 degrees Celsius, say, could it happen in a matter of months or even a year because of the chaotic nature and the complexity of the system and the fact that all these positive feedbacks, like the methane release and the darkening of the ocean and all that stuff is coming. Couldn't we get real warm real fast is my question.
Boy, that's an interesting one. I'm not sure we have enough time to answer that question right at the moment. So let's, Carl, stay listening. Kobe, you stay online here. We're going to take a quick break. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. They'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back with an answer. Taking a look at the weather and our climate today with our two weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller. The weather guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman, also a member of that department, and he directs as well the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So if you have a question or comment about the weather, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a great weather photo, we've had some wonderful photos up on our Facebook page. Go to our Facebook page. The title is The Larry Mueller Show, and post your weather photo there. When we broke for news, Carl from Verona was on and wondered if the climate could turn hotter much more quickly. You know, we typically talk in terms of decades or beyond. And he was wondering, well, could we have something that changed within a year or two?
Yeah, the characteristic timescale that most of the reporting on climate changes has taken over the last, you know, several years that it's been a high-profile issue has been the century sort of timescale. But a lot of the recent research has suggested that there maybe have been actual historic incidents of this, and maybe there are also things that may come up in the near future that are on the decades timescale, maybe 50 or so years. And I think that the reason for the increased rapidity is that we don't have a complete catalog of all of the possible feedbacks that are part of the climate system, and so we're starting to discover new ones all the time and how they might exacerbate a tendency to already stop warming, and so they could accelerate it the more of them that we become aware of and know and understand better. So there is a tendency perhaps for that time scale to shrink a little bit, but I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where we might have to worry that 2 months from now or 2 years from now the whole globe is going to be fundamentally different as a result of what the kind of change that's occurring right now. I think that's probably too quick.
Okay. All right. There we go. Thanks again for that question, Carl. Let's go to Kobe in Stone Lake. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a question a little bit different. I'm wondering if lightning strikes the surface of a lake, what happens to the creatures in the vicinity of that lightning strike in the water, the fishes and the other creatures in the water?
Mm. Sure.
They jump just like we do. No. No, I think, so when lightning hits a water body, water is really conductive, so it spreads out pretty quickly.
Doesn't go down deep.
It doesn't go down deep. It generally stays along the surface, and, you know, how far it'll spread along the surface is a function of the strike. So I don't think it'll affect the fish very much unless they're at the surface or very near the surface.
And within 20 feet or so, maybe.
And within, a short distance of where the strike actually hit. Yeah, so if a strike hits a lily pad, then probably a lot of frogs would be dead. But I'm not sure about the fish underneath.
Yeah, if it's really intense, as Steve said, it's a function of the intensity of the strike. If it's a really intense bolt, maybe you have a bigger ecological impact. But, yeah, we were kind of surprised to find that the impact is fairly limited.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks, Cole.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Tom and Eau Claire up next. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry.
What
I have
we,
a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
On August 12th, I was on a flight back from Seattle, Washington to Eau Claire, to Minneapolis. And when we were over Grand Forks, North Dakota, the pilot came on and said, we're experiencing a little turbulence. We're going to take it up a little bit. So he rose the plane up. He came back on and said, we're at 41,000 feet now. And I thought that was pretty darn high.
Mm. Actually, that is. They usually fly at like 33,000, 35,000.
Mm. Yeah, I was usually around that. And as I looked out, I saw this beautiful tops of cumulus clouds, towering cumulus clouds, and we were over the tops of them.
Yeah.
That's why he went to 41,000 feet.
Yeah. And you're in the summertime. That's why you have to go that high to get into the lower stratosphere, because the tropopause is higher. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he wanted to be down in that soup. But
no.
So there we were, and I'm thinking, Grand Forks at that hour of the morning was 80 degrees.
Mm.
What is the temperature outside the cabin of that plane, I wonder?
Probably about minus 45 Celsius, so about the same in degrees Fahrenheit. So it really cold.
It's really darn cold. I did see some perfect little ice crystals outside the window of the
plane.
And I just wanted a confirmation from you folks because, you know, I have tried to figure this out, you know, that 3 degrees for a 1,000-foot rise, and I did, and I told my wife that, and she said, yeah, go mow the lawn.
Boy, Steve and I have never heard such a response.
So I'm glad I got you guys to back up.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
You know, regard to planes flying over these convection tops, too, it reminds me of a story where we were at a NASA experiment, and we had the ER-2, which flies at like 60,000 feet, and it simulates a satellite. We had a precursor to some satellite instruments flying. And I mistakenly, you know, laid out the path that they should take and mistakenly sent them over one of these overshooting tops. And boy, when he landed, the pilot landed, he was furious. Because when I went back and looked at the altitude change, as he went over that turret, he went up 5 kilometers and down 5 kilometers within less than a minute.
Wow. Tossed around like an annoying
insect. Tossed around
insect.
So even when you're at 40,000 feet and flying above these things, you can still get those energy waves being propagated upwards that can send you a lot of turbulence.
So how was the data?
The data was great. You know, we could see this pileus cloud and the LIDAR.
It was awesome.
I was all excited, but I just sat there and apologized. Well, he just reamed me out.
Oh, man.
Well, Grayson in Wakefield hopefully is not going to ream me out. Let's go there. Hi, Grayson. Thanks for calling.
How are you doing, sir? I was a helicopter pilot until I retired a few years ago, and I have been caught in a thunderstorm now and then, and it's no fun.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to thank you gentlemen and Margaret Mooney, too, for putting on the great Changing Great Lakes Weather MOOC. I actually was down in Mercer and then up here in Wakefield, our library, and we had a four-part series to match yours. And what was really interesting was the issue about these torrential downpours, and then no more than a year later, we had one.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, wow, that sure drove point home that, yeah, maybe the weather's changing. And I just want to say thanks, and maybe you could reopen that Great Lakes, Changing Great Lakes Weather for another go, maybe update it a little bit. That was an excellent presentation. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you two questions. So, yeah, Margaret actually and I are talking about what to do with that in the next round. And as you know, I think that we went around to the different libraries because I think you wrote an editorial in your local paper about it. Is that right?
Yeah, I hit quite a few.
Okay, yeah, because I had actually a colleague of mine who lives up in that area, went home and was visiting. I forget the town. He was just outside Wakefield, actually in the UP, and he was reading the paper, and he saw the MOOC in my name, and he brought it back to me when he came back to Madison's, and he said, look at this.
Awesome.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, unfortunately, your predictions or climate predictions that are done by scientists, unfortunately, were spot on and sort of raised awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call.
And keep writing those editorials.
Yeah.
So you're doing another one?
We're talking about how to do it more effectively. The thing about the MOOC that Grayson's talking about.
What is a MOOC,
really,
by the way, for those who don't know?
So a MOOC is a massive online open course, and the university was experimenting with that. And so Margaret and I and John was one of the guest lecturers.
Yeah, it was fun.
Did this online activity. And the most fun thing from my point of view was we went across and visited 21 different Wisconsin libraries, public libraries.
Very cool.
And as they did the MOOC, then we would come and visit them on the weekend and talk about topics and things like that. And it was great. We really enjoyed it, really learned a lot.
Good participation, too, if I'm not mistaken.
And good participation, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there was a time, this was like 2 years ago, so we still have politicians saying climate change isn't real, which is absurd. But
yeah.
It was great to go out to these local these locations from both rural, from, you know, way up northern Wisconsin, you know, to Milwaukee and Madison, and see that the public knows that it's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're looking at what can they do and what the impact is going to be on their community. So it was really inspiring.
People are not dumb about the weather.
Yeah.
They are right on top of it.
Right.
Yeah. Grayson, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. John in Richland Center, it's your turn next. Hi.
Hi. I read a paper from a NASA scientist who said that the solar cycles, including sunspots, are going to be causing a cold trend on the Earth for the next 20 years. Have you heard anything?
Not for the next 20 years. The physics isn't there to justify that. I think I could guess at who the person is that wrote that article. He actually is a former NASA guy, but likes to say that he was a NASA guy, and he's a climate denier. He says that it's not happening. And most of the arguments that he used are either very, what I'll call cherry-picked, you know, you're just picking one little thing and not looking at all the data, or just an outright wrong analysis, for sure. But yeah, and that's not to say that the sun doesn't have an impact on the climate. The sun-earth relationship in terms of how much energy we get, that's what supplies all of life, let alone our weather on our planet, does change on a geological timescale. And that's why we have the ice ages. Not just so much because of the output of the sun, but the geometry between the Earth and how it rotates the sun determines how much energy we get.
Mm. Here we go. Very interesting. Thank you for calling. Jerry in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to reconcile two things. One is, when have we not had climate change? People are very resistant to change, but it seems to me we've always had climate change.
Mm.
And when I Google, which came first, increased temperature or increased carbon dioxide, it always comes up that increased temperature came first. So that would imply that the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere does not cause increased temperature.
That would imply that, except it's not true. the record speaks the other way. And you're right to say that the planet's climate is always changing. It's not a fixed entity. We've never had a climate change that has had to do with human beings affecting the chemical composition of the atmosphere until the current day. But we have had giant fluctuations in the carbon dioxide fraction of the atmosphere, as best we can measure it through bubbles that are trapped in ice cores that are hundreds of thousands of years old. You can bring them into the laboratory and you can determine what the fraction of that gas in that air bubble is as carbon dioxide and measure, therefore, what it was ambiently at the time that the ice was formed. And the carbon dioxide fraction is the one that starts to move, and then the temperature follows in lockstep to that. So, and that's physically understood as well. It isn't just that we try and read those. We wouldn't call them tea leaves, but if you did, you'd say you're trying to read them as accurately as possible without an underlying theory, and that's just not the case. There's an underlying theory that makes sense of the observations, and so you feel pretty confident that you've got a compelling story as a consequence of that. So, but it's easy for people to intentionally or otherwise mix up that relationship between what comes first and what comes next, and the reality is that the carbon dioxide fraction does govern the temperature or the average temperature of the planet to a large extent.
I was just reading recently that we're now able to go back and find climate change, human effects of climate change going back even quite a ways further back than we had previously been the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways when we talk about how humans affect climate. One is on the global scale, which has really been happening since the industrial age, and more importantly, in the last 20 years, is where you really see the rapid change of what's happening. And the other is on a local scale. Humans move into an area, and as that population grows, they're going to change that environment. And we sort of see that in urban. The urban heat island effect.
Right. And I imagine even hundreds and maybe even thousands of years ago, substantial agricultural industry done by people could make a big difference in the climate of such a location where people might live for 300 or 400 years as a civilization. So
there we go. You can join in, too, by the way. I'm going to take a Facebook question next, but the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Call in with your question. Timothy on Facebook asks, how many miles an hour does the wind have to blow before it sounds like a jet engine? This happened in Avoca for about a minute last Thursday, and it took out many trees. It was right before the rain started.
I think I can only speak from my own experience. There's no particular theoretical reason to say this, but when I've heard such winds in a few times in my lifetime and then gone back to find out what was the observation, it's usually somewhere around the 70 mile per hour range, I think.
Wow. Something like that. That would take down a tree.
Yeah, it takes down trees. Yeah, and it almost blows you over when you're outside, but it really does sound like almost like a freight train and a jet engine combined. So
there we go. Donna emailed to say she's lost 8 different kinds of trees on her property over the last 15 years. Her neighbors, both within 50 feet, haven't lost any. The houses face a park. Is it possible she's in a wind tunnel? Also, does wind travel a path when it gets over a certain speed?
That's a good question. So she's losing those trees because they're getting blown down, I assume?
She doesn't say that. So
she infers it by being in a one wind tunnel.
Yeah. Or the trees are weaker than her neighbor's trees. And it's a combination of things where you can have a funneling effect depending on all kinds of things. What does the street look like? Are there hills nearby? Are you at the nozzle of the hills or something? And then maybe the trees are weaker and they don't look that weak. They don't look any weaker than your neighbor's trees, but that might be part of it too.
But it's interesting because, every now and then, I know there was a windstorm that just moved through the Madison area, north of Madison, I think, where you see these one single big tree knocked down.
I know.
Roots ripped up and everything, and no other trees around it.
Yeah.
There must be some, little gust of wind that hits the tree and in the wrong way, and up it comes.
Puts it over the threshold. Yeah. That's also possible, right?
Tom in Madison has a question. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I'm wondering what your guests, I know they're not economists, but I wonder what they think about carbon taxes as a way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. What do atmospheric scientists think about that as a policy option?
Yeah, I'm not an economist, but it strikes me that, and so I'll just speak about it as a science issue, if a common resource we all share, our atmosphere, is being polluted preferentially by certain kinds of industry, then maybe that industry ought to pay a little bit to figure out how to help us mitigate against the changes that it's creating by dumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I guess in that sense, I think it's a very good discussion for all of us to have. It's just to say, how do we charge ourselves for this contamination of our atmosphere? And what's the best way to do that? I don't know. But the carbon tax is one of several you might put on that list to have for a discussion.
Yeah.
And I would just add that it's about time we have those discussions and stop trying to argue about whether or not climate change is real or not. We know it's real, so let's move on and figure out what to
do. That's right. That's where our energy should be, on these discussions, not these other ones.
Tom, thanks for calling. Pete in Ashland up next. Hi, Pete.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got kind of a different take. What is microwave communication in the advent and use increased use of cellular phone systems? What kind of impact does that have on warming water vapor in the atmosphere and then contributing to climate change? And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Directly none, and that's because they're picking microwave wavelengths in which the atmosphere is transparent. And so the microwaves are moving through the atmosphere and not being absorbed. We do use microwaves to observe the atmosphere, but then we're picking those frequencies at which, for example, water vapor will absorb those. And if they're absorbing, then they're emitting. And so the cell phone towers won't have an impact on the atmosphere. The problem becomes, indirectly, is that as we get more cell phones and start eating up these frequencies for communications, weather observations use similar microwave frequencies to download satellite data and things like that. And so as the cell phone expands into that communication frequency, it impacts the satellite observations in terms of delivering the data, not in terms of affecting the atmosphere. And that's becoming, in fact, the U.S. government's about to put up for sale, because they sell these frequencies, just like they do radio waves, put them up for sale, and they're interfering, you know, with the 415 megahertz cycle, for example, which a lot of the wind profilers use. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue indirectly in that we like to use those wavelengths or frequencies for communication as well as cell phone companies.
Jeremy and Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I was calling to see if a guest had a good resource for a layperson who's interested in looking at what kinds of changes might be in store for different regions in North America over the next 25 years. I'm looking to buy a farm, possibly in the upper Midwest or maybe in New England or eastern Canada, and climate's a really important consideration in vegetable production. So I was wondering if there's a resource that I could be pointed towards that would have some of the best current predictions for what it's going to be like over the next few decades.
Yeah, so one site I would look to is, I forget, it'll end in climate.gov. So if you search on climate, gov, you know, that's coming from NOAA, and I think EPA is involved as well. And they're looking at what the climate impacts are and gearing it towards the layperson, the person like you who's interested in trying to understand it.
There may be something, too, I don't know, on the IPCC website, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which you might try and find that. They have a really nice summary for policymakers, and I, as one example of translating the current state of the art knowledge into layman's terms, but there may also be things that have specifically maps of agriculturally favorable locations in the next 50 or so years, and so on. I don't know, but they may.
Yeah. I think they do.
There we
actually,
go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeremy, and Dan in Presque Isle. Do you have a quick question?
Yeah. Hey, hi guys. I heard the other morning, and I believe it was a Today Show, that the U.S. has got a new weather satellite, I might be wrong, Goes On, I thought was what they were going to call it. It was going to put us on top of the satellite program for weather.
What do you think? Is it there?
There was a lot of good promo on it, and it's great, and we're all looking forward to it. It's called GOES-R, as you said, and then once it gets launched and checked out, the R will change from a letter to a number. And I would hold, there's a lot of promo, and don't get me wrong, you know, I'm a satellite guy. I think it's going to be great to get it. We're going to learn that kind of stuff. But I can tell you the Europeans have had this for 3 years. and the Japanese, 2 years ago, launched the same instrument that we're about to launch. So, again, I would argue that, you know, this is great. It's really going to help. But, you know, yeah, no, it is not the newest and greatest. In fact, it was designed in the early 1990s, and if you go back in time, I'm going to just say for our NOAA guys who are here, who likes to point out, it was actually supposed to be launched before 2010. So,
on that note, right. We'll see you guys the last Monday of September. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys, will be back, and thank you very much for listening. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk joins us tomorrow here on the Ideas Net.